Ancient sea hamper was a natural shot, Merlin Athrawes decided as he watched Empress Charlian's personal armsman at pistol practice. And so, he reflected wryly, is Charlian herself. Not very ladylike of her, I suppose. He chuckled silently. On the other hand, the lady does seem to have a style all her own, doesn't she? Had anyone happened to glance into Merlin's small, cramped cabin aboard HMS Empress of Caris, he would undoubtedly have assumed Merlin was asleep. After all, it was already 2 hours after sunset aboard the fleet flagship, even though there were still several hours of light left back home in Telesburg. That might be a bit early, but Captain Athrawes had the morning watch at Emperor Caleb's back, so it made sense for him to get to bed as early as possible. And at the moment, he was stretched out in the box-like cot suspended from the overhead, swaying gently with the ship's motion, eyes closed, breathing deep and regular. Except, of course, that whatever it looked like, he wasn't actually breathing at all. The individual known as Merlin Athrawes hadn't done that in the last 900 years or so. Dead women didn't, after all, and Pikas had no need to do anything so limiting. There was no real need for him to be feigning sleep, or breathing, for that matter, he supposed either. No one was likely to barge in on Emperor Caleb's personal armsman during his off-duty time, and even if anyone had, Merlin's reflexes were as inhumanly fast as his hearing was inhumanly acute. Someone whose nervous impulses moved 100 times more rapidly than any organic human's would have had plenty of time to get his eyes closed and his breathing started up again. But Merlin had no intention of getting sloppy about the minor details. There were sufficient peculiar tales already circulating about Sajin Merlin and his powers as it was. Of course, even the most peculiar tale fell far short of the reality, and he planned to keep it that way for as long as possible, which meant forever if he could only pull it off. That was the entire reason he had decided at the outset to assume the persona of a Sajin, one of the warrior monks who came and went through the pages of legend here on the planet Safehold. Sajin were reputed to have so many different marvelous capabilities that almost anything Merlin did could be explained away with the proper hand-waving. Assuming the hand-wavers in question can keep a straight face while they do it, at any rate, he reminded himself. So far, the tiny handful of people who knew the truth about Merlin had managed to do just that, helped, no doubt, by the fact that the truth would have been even more bizarre. Explaining that he was a Sajin was ever so much simpler than explaining to a planet systematically indoctrinated with an anti-technology mindset that he was the personality-integrated cybernetic avatar of a young woman named Nemu Albon who'd been born on a planet named Earth and been dead for the better part of 1,000 years. All too often, Merlin found it sufficiently difficult to wrap his own mind about that particular concept. His artificial body, with its fiber-optic nerves and fusion-powered muscles, was now the home of Nimmu's memories, hopes, dreams, and responsibilities. Since those responsibilities included breaking the Church of God Awaiting's anti-technology stranglehold on Safehold, rebuilding the technological society which had been renounced 1,000 years ago in the name of survival, and preparing the last planet of human beings in the entire universe for the inevitable moment in which it re-encountered the species which had come within an eyelash of exterminating humanity the first time they'd met, it was perhaps fortunate that a Pika was the next best thing to indestructible and potentially immortal. It was also fortunate that no more than 25 people in the entire world knew the full truth of who and what Merlin was, or about his true mission here on Safehold, he reflected, then frowned mentally. All of those 25 people happened to be male. And, as he watched Empress Charlian's personal detachment of the Imperial Carizian Guard punching bullets steadily through their targets on the palace firing range, he found himself once more in full agreement with Caleb that there should have been at least one woman who knew the truth. Unfortunately, deciding who was to be admitted to the full truth about humanity's presence here on Safehold and about Merlin was not solely up to them. If it had been, Charlian would have been added to the ranks of those who knew both of those secrets long before Caleb had sailed from Karis with the invasion fleet bound for the League of Coruscant. "You can't have everything, Merlin," he reminded himself once again. "And sooner or later, Michael is going to manage to bring the rest of the brethren of Saint Journaux around. Of course, just who's going to do the explaining to her with Caleb and you, the better part of 9 or 10,000 miles away, is an interesting question, isn't it?" Personally, Merlin was of the opinion that Archbishop Michael Stainer, the ecclesiastic head of the schismatic Church of Karis, couldn't possibly convince his more recalcitrant brethren soon enough. Captain Athrawes sympathized completely with the other's caution, but leaving Charlian in ignorance was short-sighted, to say the very least. In fact, the word stupid suggested itself to him rather forcefully whenever he contemplated the brethren's hesitation. Charlian was far too intelligent and capable to be left out of the loop. Even without full information, she'd already demonstrated just how dangerously effective she could be against Karis's enemies. With it, she would become even more deadly. "Which doesn't even consider the minor fact that she's Caleb's wife, does it?" Merlin grimaced behind the composed facade of his sleeping face. "No wonder Caleb's mad enough to chew iron and spit nails. It'd be bad enough if he didn't love her, but he does. And even on the most hard-boiled, pragmatic level, he's still right. She has a right to know. In fact, given the risks she's chosen to run, the enemies she's chosen to make in the name of justice and the truth, there's no one on this entire planet, including Caleb himself, who has a better right. And if I were she, I'd be pissed off as hell when I finally found out what my husband's advisors had been keeping from me." Unfortunately, he thought, returning his attention to the images of the practicing guardsmen relayed through one of his carefully stealthed reconnaissance platforms, that was one bridge they'd have no choice but to cross when they reached it. All he could do now was hope for the best, and take a certain comfort from the obvious efficiency of her guard detachment. They wouldn't have the chance to explain anything to her if some of the lunatics who'd already attempted to assassinate Archbishop Michael in his own cathedral managed to kill her first. And given the fact that even with all of the advantages of Merlin's reconnaissance capabilities, he still hadn't been able to determine whether or not those assassins had acted on their own, or how big any supporting organization might have been, Captain Athrawes was delighted by the evidence of Sergeant Seahamper's competence. He would have preferred being close enough to protect Charlian himself, but not even he could be in two places at once, and Caleb needed looking after as well. And at least, if he couldn't be there in person, Seahamper made a satisfying substitute. While Merlin watched, the sergeant finished reloading his double-barreled flintlock pistol, cocked and primed both locks, raised it in the two-handed shooting stance Merlin had introduced, and added two more petals to the ragged flower of bullet holes he'd blown through the target silhouette's head. He was firing from a range of 25 yards, and the maximum spread of the group he'd produced was no more than 6 inches, For someone who'd never even fired a pistol until less than 4 months ago, that was a remarkable performance, especially with a flintlock he had to stop and reload after every pair of shots. Merlin could have produced a much tighter group, of course, but Nimue wouldn't have been able to when she'd still been alive. Of course, as Merlin, he had certain advantages which Sea Hamper, or any other mortal human being, lacked. The sergeant was almost as good a shot with a rifle, although it was readily apparent that he was actually more comfortable with the pistol. And while Charlian's other guardsmen might not be quite up to Sea Hamper's standard, all of them had become excellent marksmen, as had the Empress herself. Merlin never doubted that quite a few Safeholdian males would have considered Charlian's interest in firearms distinctly unbecoming in a properly reared young woman of gentle birth. After all, they were noisy, smoky, dirty, smelly, and dangerous. Like all black powder weapons, they produced an enormous amount of fouling, not to mention blackening the hands and faces of everyone in the vicinity. And besides, doing things like shooting holes in targets, or even in other people, was what the Empress had guardsmen for. Unhappily for those chauvinistic sticklers, Charlian Tate Armok liked guns. The recoil from the guardsmen's rifles was undeniably on the brutal side, and the standard pistols were a bit too big and too heavy for her slender hands to manage comfortably. But Sea Hamper and Captain Willis Geratt, the official commander of her guard detachment, had both known her since she was an imperious child queen. They knew exactly what sort of force of nature she was. When she'd expressed a desire for weapons better sized for her not-quite-petite frame, they'd quickly commissioned just that. Besides, Merlin suspected that they found the notion that their charge could shoot considerably better than the vast majority of her guardsmen rather comforting. He certainly did. Now he spent a few more minutes watching through his distant remotes as Charlian methodically demolished her own silhouette. "She's going to need a bath before this evening's council meeting," he reflected with an inner chuckle, watching her smear the powder grime on her forehead as she wiped away sweat. "And when she sits down with the councillors, not a one of them would believe what she looks like right now." He smiled as he watched her guardsmen watching her accuracy with obvious possessive pride, then, regretfully, turned his attention elsewhere. He was still a little surprised by how homesick he was for Telesburg, but the city had been his home for almost 3 years. That was actually much longer than Nimue Alban had lived in any one spot from the day she'd graduated from the Naval Academy on Old Earth until the day of her death. Besides, home was where the people someone cared about lived. Unfortunately, Merlin had already discovered that no one, not even a Pika who could, at least theoretically, go indefinitely without sleeping, could possibly keep track of everything he had to keep track of. He needed to know what was going on in Telesburg, and on a personal level, he needed an occasional fix of watching over the people he and Caleb had left behind when they sailed. Yet he couldn't afford to let himself spend too much time doing that, however tempting it might have been. "Do you have that summary from Chisholm, Owl?" he asked over his built-in communicator, without ever moving his lips. "Yes, Lieutenant Commander," the AI, hidden away in Nimue's cave, the distant cavern where Nimue's Pika had lain concealed for so many centuries, replied. "Then I suppose I'd better take a look at it too, shouldn't I?" Merlin sighed. "Yes, Lieutenant Commander," Owl replied obediently. "Well, go ahead and begin the transmission." "Yes, Lieutenant Commander." 3. House of Quentin, City of Sidar, Republic of Sidarmark.
It seems we're all present, gentlemen. Please, be seated.
The half-dozen men in the private dining room looked up as one when their host stepped through the expensive paneled door and smiled at them. Answering smiles were notable for their absence. If the immaculately groomed silver-haired man was perturbed by the taut expressions of his guests, he allowed no sign of it to cross his own face. He simply stepped forward, with the assurance that went with both his age and his stature within the Sidarmarkian business community. His name was Timon Quentin, and he was probably the wealthiest private citizen in the entire Republic of Sidarmark. At 73 years of age, 66 in the years of Old Earth, although no one in Sidarmark was even aware that a place called Old Earth had ever existed, he remained vigorous and actively engaged. It was said, not without reason, that there was not a business transaction in all of Sidarmark which didn't have a Quentin involved in it somewhere, and Timon was the acknowledged patriarch of the world-spanning family business. He was one of the Lord Protector's intimates and a financial advisor to dukes, princes, kings, and vicars. He knew everyone everywhere, and he had built a lifetime reputation as a man whose word could be trusted and whose enmity was to be feared. When Timon Quentin issued a dinner invitation, it was accepted. Even if some of the individuals on the guest list were more than a little anxious about just what he might have in mind, this evening's invitees strongly suspected the reason they'd been called together, and there was a general air of nervousness as they waited to find out if their suspicions were accurate.
"Thank you all for coming," Quentin said,
exactly as if there'd been any probability that they might not have.
"I'm sure that in these times of uncertainty, all of us can appreciate the necessity for men of goodwill to extend the hand of friendship to one another," he continued. "Especially when the well-being of so many other people depends upon the decisions those men of goodwill make."
The tension ratcheted slightly higher, and he smiled as if he both sensed their increased anxiety and was amused by it.
"I'm quite confident that all of us know one another," he said, seating himself at the head of the table. "That being the case, I see no particular need for introductions."
One or two heads nodded in agreement. Most of them did, in fact, know one another, but there were definitely times when official anonymity was greatly to be desired.
"I'll come directly to the point, gentlemen," Quentin continued. "I invited you here not simply in my private capacity as a senior stockholder in the House of Quentin, but also as a concerned citizen of the Republic. I have concerns of my own, obviously, but I have also been the recipient of certain statements of anxiety from other citizens, both within and without the government. Obviously, those anxieties have been expressed as one private individual speaking to another private individual. So please, do not make the mistake of assuming that this meeting bears any particular official stamp of approval, as it were."
No one bothered to nod this time. Despite any qualifications he might voice for the record, Timon Quentin did not mention contacts with anyone within and without the government unless he was in fact speaking for that government, or at least for those with very powerful interests within it. And given his close personal relationship with the Lord Protector, the chance that he would even consider acting against Gregor Stonar's expressed desires was effectively non-existent. The only question in the minds of his guests was not whether or not he was being used as a sub rosa conduit by the Lord Protector, but rather exactly what it was that Stonar wanted to tell them.
Recent events, both here in the Republic and elsewhere, Quentin continued after a moment, have resulted in extraordinary dislocations of business and finance. I'm certain all of you have experienced some of the dislocations to which I refer. And, as myself, I feel certain you're deeply distressed by the open schism between the Kingdom of Karis, excuse me, the Empire of Karis, and the Knights of the Temple Lands. In a time rife with so much uncertainty, it becomes inevitable that markets will be depressed, that trade will be dislocated and businesses will falter, and that some of those businesses will fail, with disastrous consequences not simply for their owners and shareholders, but also for those who depend upon them as a means to earn their own livelihood. While I feel confident none of us would dispute the Knights of the Temple Lands' right to formulate their own foreign policy as they see best, or contest the will of the Grand Inquisitor when he acts to protect all of us from potential heresy and spiritual contamination, we may perhaps be aware of certain consequences of those decisions which have not occurred to those charged with making them. In particular, the decision to ban all Carisian flag merchant vessels from the ports of the Republic, and, for that matter, of every other mainland port, is already producing business failures. At the moment, that's largely due to the panic effect, but the consequences, the ultimate consequences, will be only too real. To be blunt, the collapse of more than a few trading houses would appear to be imminent, and if and when those houses fail, their collapse will be like stones dropped into pools of water. Ripples of additional failure will sweep outward from them, crossing and crisscrossing with potentially disastrous effects, which will know no limitations of flag or border. He paused, and four of his guests very carefully did not look at the remaining two. Silence lingered for several minutes, and then one of the men no one else was looking at cleared his throat.
"No doubt your analysis is as accurate and pertinent as always, Master Quentin," he said with a pronounced Carisian accent. "And I trust you'll forgive me if I might seem to be getting ahead of events, or perhaps even appear to be putting words into your mouth. But may we assume that one of the reasons for your invitation this evening is to discuss ways in which those unfortunate repercussions could be ameliorated?"
"In a manner of speaking, certainly," Quentin replied. Then he leaned back in his chair, folding his hands before him on the tabletop, and smiled almost whimsically. "Obviously, the spiritual well-being of the Church's flock must be the first responsibility and concern of the Grand Inquisitor. No one could possibly dispute that fact. Nonetheless, there have been occasions in the history of the Knights of the Temple Lands when their policies have required the interpolation of those outside the Temple Lands, if their true objectives were to be accomplished. Several people I've spoken to over the last few 5 days are of the opinion that it's at least possible this may be another of those occasions." "In what way, Master Quentin?" one of his other guests asked in guarded tones. "It seems evident that the Grand Inquisitor's objective is to minimize contact between potentially apostate Carisians and the citizens of the Republic," Quentin said calmly. "One can hardly draw any other conclusion from his directives, not to mention his explicit instructions to the Lord Protector and to the other heads of state of the major mainland realms. The possibility that the consequences of his directives may very well exceed his intentions clearly exists, however. It's been suggested to me that perhaps it would not be inappropriate for those of us deeply involved in international trade and investment to consider ways in which certain of those unanticipated consequences might be minimized. For example, The Grand Inquisitor has specifically directed that our ports are to be closed against any and all Carisian flag vessels. None of us, I'm certain, would ever even consider setting our own will in opposition to the commands of the Grand Inquisitor. However, his directives refer specifically to the realm where a ship is registered. There was nothing in them which pertained to where a ship might have been built, or even where its cargo might have originated. He smiled benevolently at his listeners. My own house has recently signed a long-term lease-purchase agreement, by which we have taken possession of several dozen Carisian-built merchant ships. Since the agreement is a lease-purchase, it's obviously in our best interests to secure our ownership interest in the vessels, especially in these troubled times. Accordingly, their registries have been transferred from those of the kingdom in which they were built to the Republic, where their current owners are located. Eyes narrowed around the table as his guests digested that. It was true that the Grand Inquisitor's orders had specified the seizure of Carisian-owned vessels. If ships were no longer registered in Caris, and if their owners were no longer Carisian subjects, then the letter of Vicar Jaspar's commands would no longer apply. Still, have you discussed these lease purchases with the Chancellor's office? The Carisian-accented guest asked slowly. There's been no need to involve the Chancellor in such routine transactions, Quentin said tranquilly. Obviously, his office is aware of them, however, since it's responded most favorably and promptly to our requests to expedite the registration of the transfers of title. I see. The Carisian and the others seated around the table digested that as well. Given the fact that the vessels themselves would be useless without crews to man them, and given the fact that the Sidharmarchian merchant marine was virtually non-existent, a rather delicate question arose. After several seconds, one of the other guests cleared his throat.
I can well appreciate how the transactions you've described would go far towards meeting the Grand Inquisitor's desires, while simultaneously providing the necessary bottoms to keep essential commerce moving. My own shareholders might well be interested in participating in similar transactions, but alas, we do not possess a stock of trained sailors from which to provide crews.
As a matter of fact, that presented certain difficulties to us as well, Quentin said, nodding gravely. We determined that the simplest decision was to hire the additional sailors we required. In fact, the sellers were kind enough to provide us with the trained seamen we needed. The simplest solution, actually, was simply to hire the passage crews who delivered the vessels to us. Obviously, they were already familiar with the ships in question, and the majority of them had no objection to sailing under Sidharmarchian colors. One ship is very like another, after all.
Eyebrows rose. It was abundantly clear that the legal maneuver Quentin was describing was no more than a paper transaction. And if that was clear to them, they felt confident it would be clear to others. The possibility that Jaspar Clinton would be unhappy when he learned of it appeared significant, but it was obvious Quentin was, in fact, acting as the Lord Protector's messenger in this instance. And while it was undoubtedly true that the Grand Inquisitor's wrath and the disapproval of the Knights of the Temple Lands was not something to be lightly contemplated, it was also true that the Lord Protector was far closer to them. With winter closing in, it was even conceivable that some 5 days would pass before anyone in Zion learned of this particular maneuver. And if, or when, Vicar Jaspar learned of it, the Church's long-standing policy of not pushing Sidharmark too hard would undoubtedly come into play. The most probable negative outcome would be a forced repudiation of the lease purchases, and it was highly probable that the Republic's diplomats and lawmasters would be able to spin even that out for months. Months during which the official owners of the vessels in question would be making money hand over fist in markets where the general reduction in shipping would enforce scarcity and drive prices steadily upward. And if the Lord Protector's administration was prepared to pursue this arrangement, who knew what other arrangements it might be prepared to sanction as well? Several eyes slid sideways towards one of the guests in particular. He was neither Carisian nor Sidarmarkian, and his tunic sleeve carried an embroidered crown surmounted by crossed keys. The crown in question was orange, not white, which meant he was a senior bailiff for a member of the Council of Vicars, and not some lowly archbishop or bishop. His presence had been unexpected, and more than one of the other guests waited to hear him denounce what Quentin had just said. Instead, he simply frowned thoughtfully. If he felt the intensity of the regards directed at him, he gave no sign of it, but after a few moments, he nodded.
As you say, Master Quentin, the consequences of the exclusion of Carisian-owned shipping have already been profound. And, like most of the people in this room, I'm responsible for serving the best interests of my patrons. Clearly, the upward surge in prices is making that significantly more difficult. I feel quite confident that my employers would wish me to explore every possible avenue by which those rising prices might be controlled. I think this lease-purchase arrangement of yours has a great deal to recommend itself as a means whereby the Grand Inquisitor's directives and intentions can be given effect without bringing about a total collapse of our maritime commerce or imposing disastrously high prices. In fact, it would seem to me that the purchasing approach you've chosen to follow is only one of several possible options. For example, had you considered...
The atmosphere around the table shifted noticeably as the bailiff leaned forward, his eyes intent. Business is business. They could almost physically hear him saying that, although they all knew he would never, under any circumstances, admit that he had. The arrangements they were discussing probably wouldn't last, yet they might very well hold up for quite some time. And if the Lord Protector remained as willing to pursue innovative solutions, as he clearly was at this moment, some fresh arrangement would undoubtedly be waiting in the wings when the Church finally got around to quashing this one. Which suggested all sorts of interesting future possibilities. 4. Priory of St. Hamlin, City of Serene, Earldom of Rivermouth, Kingdom of Caris.
"Excuse me, my lord, sir," the rather plainly dressed young man said.
The almost equally plainly dressed older man looked up with a chiding expression, but he permitted the self-correction to pass unremarked. This time.
"Yes, Alvin," he said instead.
"There's a messenger from Telesburg," Alvin Shumay told him.
"Really?"
The older man, who tried very hard to remind himself that he was no longer Bishop Miles Halcombe, officially, at least, sat back in his chair and quirked an eyebrow.
"Yes, sir, from our friend in Telesburg."
Halcombe's raised eyebrow smoothed magically. As a matter of fact, he'd discovered quite a few friends in Telesburg, more, really, than he'd hoped for after his hasty departure from his own see in Hanthtown. At this particular moment, however, there was only one of them for whose messages Shumay would have interrupted him. And if his aide sometimes had trouble breaking the habit of addressing Halcombe as a bishop,
He demonstrated a much greater ability to remember never to mention names unless he absolutely had to.
I see. Halcom gazed thoughtfully at Shumei for a handful of seconds, then shrugged very slightly.
Is there anything I need to do about it immediately, Alvin?
As a matter of fact, no, sir, Shumei replied. I just thought you'd like to know that he seems to have experienced no undue difficulty in making the arrangements you asked him to see to.
Thank you, Alvin. That's very good news.
Of course, sir, Shumei murmured and withdrew.
Halcom gazed after him for a moment, then turned back to the brown-bearded man in the white, lamp-badged brown habit of an upper priest in the Order of Bedard. That robe was girdled by the white rope belt which marked him as the head of a monastic community, a fact which had a great deal to do with Halcom's presence in this remarkably Spartan office.
"Please excuse the interruption, Father Oswald," he said. "I'm afraid I may have overly impressed Alvin with the need to deliver messages promptly."
"Please, my lord," Father Oswald shook his head. "Don't concern yourself. Father Alvin has been with you in the Dragon's Mouth. If he thinks you need to know something, then I'm quite content to leave that decision in his hands."
"Thank you," Halcom said, managing not to frown as the other man used his ecclesiastic title. Actually, he supposed, it didn't really matter that much in this case. Father Oswald Banar was the head of the Priory of St. Hamlin, and the Priory was located in the city of Serene, well over 250 miles from Telesburg. It was unlikely that Baron Wave Thunder, Emperor Caleb's spymaster, had infiltrated any of his agents into a relatively small priory that far from the capital, and particularly not into a priory of the same order which Archbishop Michael Stainer called his own. Still, good security was a matter of developing the proper habits, and as Banar had just pointed out, Halcom had survived more than a few 5 days in the Dragon's Mouth in Telesburg itself. And once his business here in the Earldom of Rivermouth was completed, that was precisely where he'd be returning.
"Well," he said, "to return to our earlier discussion, Father, I fully realize how eager you are to strike a blow in the name of God and His Church, but I'm very much afraid that, as I said, your value to his cause is much greater where you already are."
"My lord, with all due respect, neither I nor the brothers I've called to your attention are afraid of anything apostate heretics might do to us. And the fact that we're members of the same order from which the author of this abomination sprang gives us a special responsibility to do something about it. I really think—"
"Father," Halcom interrupted, his tone as patient as he could make it,
"we have the sword arms we need. We have a plentiful supply, actually, of good and godly men prepared to do God's will in opposing what you've so rightly described as an abomination. What we need, more than anything else, is a support network, a community of the faithful, of those the schismatics have so disdainfully labeled temple loyalists, prepared to gather supplies, stockpile weapons, offer shelter, serve as message conduits, pass funds as necessary. To be totally, brutally blunt, we need that sort of network much more than we need additional fighters."
Father Oswald couldn't hide the disappointment in his expression, assuming he'd actually tried to hide it.
"Well, that's just too bad," Halcom thought, "because everything I just told him is the absolute literal truth, although I do hope we can instill at least a rudimentary sense of security into Father Oswald. I'm confident Wave Thunder isn't wasting time looking in his direction yet,
But that can always change, especially once we start staging our operations through the monastic community.
I understand what you're saying, my lord, Benar said after a moment. And I suppose, if I'm honest, that I can't really argue with your logic. Still, I can't help feeling that a fellow Bedardist might well be able to get close enough to Stainer to settle the business.
It wasn't a case of failing to get close enough, father, Halcombe responded, and his voice was much grimmer than it had been a few moments before. Believe me, our brothers got close enough to do the job easily enough, or they would have been close enough if not for Sagan Merlin.
The bishop showed his teeth in an expression no one could ever possibly have confused with a smile.
We owe the good Sagan quite a debt, he continued, recalling the reports of Emperor Caleb's personal armsmen standing balanced on the rail of the royal box in Telesburg Cathedral, smoking pistols in hand, as he shot down the three volunteers who'd actually gotten close enough to physically lay hands on the apostate archbishop. Without him, Stainer would be dead this very moment. The time will come when we settle with him too, father.
We've heard rumors about him even here, Benar said, his expression troubled. Some of the things he's supposed to have done sound preposterous, impossible.
Oh, I don't doubt that for a moment, Halcombe replied. He's extraordinarily handy with a sword, and obviously with these pistols Caleb and his cronies have invented. And he has an incredibly irritating knack for being in exactly the wrong place at exactly the wrong time.
Is it possible he has assistance in managing that, my lord? Benar asked in a very careful tone.
Is he receiving demonic assistance, do you mean, father? Halcombe asked in reply, and chuckled. I suppose anything is possible. But I'm inclined to think the superstitious give him rather too much credit. Most of the impossible things he's supposed to have done are much more probably the products of overactive imaginations than of reality. Strangling krakens with his bare hands, single-handedly slaughtering 200 or 300, or was it 500 Coruscantian sailors and marines aboard Royal Caris?
The bishop shook his head.
Athrawes is definitely a Sagan, father, and it would appear that the ridiculous legends about the martial capabilities of Sagans in general have a solid core of truth, after all. But sooner or later he's going to arrive too late, or someone is going to manage to get a sword, or an arbalest bolt, or an arrow, or a bullet, through his guard, and that's going to be the end of Sagan Merlin.
I'm sure you're right, my lord, but still... Benar let his voice trail off, and Halcombe snorted.
At the moment, father, it clearly suits the purposes of Stainer, Caleb, and their cronies to... emphasize, shall we say, Athrawes's abilities and accomplishments. After all, he's Caleb's personal armsman. Encouraging people to think he's some sort of infallible superman is likely to discourage direct attempts on the Emperor's life. And having someone capable of miraculously intervening to save Caleb or Stainer is another way for them to pretend God truly favors their apostasy. After all, would he have sent a protector like Sagan Merlin to look after Caleb to save Stainer from certain death if he didn't favor them? So it's scarcely in their interests to downplay his accomplishments, is it?
I suppose not, Benar said a bit doubtfully, and Halcombe suppressed a sigh. The prior's fixation on Captain Merlin Athrawes's apparently more than human capabilities actually only underscored what Halcombe had just said.
Many of those who supported Caleb in his insane, arrogant challenge to the authority of God himself saw in Athrawis the imprimatur of God's approval instead. It was tempting to take advantage of the concern Benar and others like him felt and label Athrawis a servant of demons, or even a demon himself. In many ways, it might be an effective tool, especially among the more poorly educated and more credulous. But it had been over 700 years since anyone had last seen a true demon. Labeling Athrawis as one now would probably lose them as much support among the better educated and informed. And if they were going to successfully combat the schism, they couldn't afford to lose that support. Besides, the opportunity it would provide for the schismatic propagandists to mock the temple loyalists' ridiculous claims was something which had to be avoided.
Mind you, there are times I'm more than half tempted to sign on to the same belief, Halcom admitted. For example, I have no intention of telling Benar about the way Merlin just happened to turn up in the nick of time to save that bastard Machlin from the bonfire we'd arranged for him. But if he really were a demon, he'd have gotten there in time to save the rest of their precious royal college as well.
The bishop smiled mentally, thinking about the literally decades of records which had gone up in the flames.
They're never going to be able to put all of that back together again, and a true demon would have recognized that and gotten there a half hour or so sooner, and a true demon would have simply arranged to have our brothers arrested or killed before they ever got close enough to strike at Steynair too. Killing them the way he actually did was certainly spectacular, but letting us get that close first only proved how deep and committed the opposition to their precious Church of Caris really is.
Trust me, Father, he said aloud. God isn't going to permit any demonic intervention, not openly at any rate. Steynair is right in at least one respect, damn him to hell. God did create man with free will. It's the exercise of that free will by men who have willingly embraced evil that we confront. But God isn't going to permit demons to openly intervene on the side of blasphemy and heresy. If that were what this Merlin truly is, we'd see angelic intervention to deal with him. The Book of Chihiro makes that abundantly clear.
Yes, Benar brightened visibly. Yes, my lord, that's true. I shouldn't have forgotten that. I suppose, he grinned almost sheepishly, that I've been so shocked by what's happening that I'm starting to jump at shadows.
You're scarcely alone in that, Father, Halcom said dryly. On the other hand, in some ways, that only underscores what I was saying earlier about our need for a secure communication network. And, frankly, for what I suppose you might call safe houses, where those who are openly striking at the forces of the apostate can feel secure between attacks. Some place where they can gather and recoup their faith and their spiritual wholeness before going back out to face the schismatics once more.
Yes, Benar nodded, slowly at first, but with gathering enthusiasm.
Yes, my lord, I can see that. And however much I might hunger to strike one of those blows myself, it's clearly my duty to serve in the most effective way possible. Not to mention the fact that, so far as I know, you're the only legitimate bishop remaining in the entire kingdom. As such, anyone truly loyal to Mother Church must obviously place himself under your direction.
I believe there are more members of the clergy of this accursed Church of Caris who would agree with you in their heart of hearts on that point than Caleb and Steynair dream,
Halcom said in a hard voice.
And the fact that they keep their faith secret, securely hidden, is a good thing for now, at least.
Benar nodded, and Halcom's nostrils flared,
Then he gave himself a small shake.
"Now, Father," he said more briskly, "I don't want to get into too many particulars at the moment, but I can tell you that we have at least one or two quite wealthy supporters here in Caris. Some of them are prepared to place that wealth at the Temple Loyalists' service. Obviously, we can't permit any one of them to contribute too heavily."
Benar looked a bit confused, and Halcombe shook his head.
"Think about it, Father," he said patiently. "It's unlikely that someone like Wave Thunder isn't making a list of people, especially wealthy or powerful people, he might suspect of Temple Loyalist sympathies. If a sizable percentage of one of those wealthy suspects' wealth should suddenly disappear, it would ring all sorts of alarm bells in Wave Thunder's mind. So it's essential that any contributions to our cause be both carefully hidden and not so large as to obviously impact upon the wealth of the contributors."
Benar was nodding again, and Halcombe sat back in his chair and raised both hands, palms uppermost.
"Fortunately, I've managed to make contact with a few people, some of them in Telesburg, some of them not, who are prepared to channel charitable contributions through various monasteries and convents and into our hands. That, to be honest, would be the greatest service St. Hamlin's could provide to our cause at this time."
No one on Safehold had yet reinvented the term money laundering, but Halcombe had the essentials of the practice down pat.
"Of course," Benar said promptly. "Think about it carefully, Father," Halcombe cautioned. "The possibility that sooner or later Wave Thunder or one of his spies is going to come up with something that could be traced back to you definitely exists. And for all of Caleb's sanctimonious disavowal of repressive measures, he's also made it clear that anyone who lends himself to supporting armed resistance to the crown or to Stainer's corrupt regime within the church will face the sternest penalties."
"I'm not in love with the concept of martyrdom, my lord," Benar replied somberly. "I'm not afraid of it either, though. If it's God's will that I should die doing his work, then I will have been blessed above all other men."
"That's true, Father," Halcombe said quietly, his eyes warm. "That's very true. In fact, it's that truth which makes it possible for me to go back into the dragon's mouth, as you put it. And sooner or later, Caleb and Stainer, and yes, even Sage and Merlin, are going to discover that no one can ultimately defeat men who remember that. And when they discover that, they're also going to find themselves giving account to God and Langhorne. And that, Father Oswald, is something they're not going to enjoy."
February, Year of God, 893. 1. Cherraeth, Kingdom of Chisholm, Empire of Caris.
"Welcome to Cherraeth, Your Majesty."
The man who'd been waiting at the foot of the gangway bowed deeply as Caleb Armach, Emperor of Caris, stepped off it onto the stone quay and set foot for the very first time upon the soil of the Kingdom of Chisholm. Caleb had never met the tall, silver-haired Chisholmian with the deep, strong voice, but he'd been looking forward to making the older man's acquaintance. Not, unfortunately, without a certain amount of trepidation. Fortunately, the Chisholmian's greeting seemed sincere, although it was hard to be certain, since just hearing him was more than a bit difficult under the circumstances. The harbor behind Caleb was crowded with Carisian warships and Carisian transports packed to the gills with Carisian marines. Even the enormous waters of Cherry Bay seemed congested and crowded well beyond their maximum capacity,
and the defensive waterfront batteries were wreathed in smoke. But the fleet behind Caleb was no invasion force come to pillage Chiraeth, and the gunsmoke, drifting away on the biting breeze of a northern winter, whose teeth made Caleb's southern blood devoutly grateful for his heavy cloak, was from the 24-gun salute which had just roared its way into silence. And if the guns had fallen silent, the shouting voices of the bundled-up Chisomians, packed black and dense into every vantage point they could find, had not. There was enthusiasm in most of those shouts. Not all. Caleb hadn't expected that, but most. Yet, however welcome that might be, they still made it hard to hear. "Thank you, my lord," Caleb replied, raising his own voice against the background tumult, then stepped forward and extended his right hand. Marak Sandirs, Baron Green Mountain, and the First Counselor of the Kingdom of Chisholm seemed surprised at the gesture. He hesitated for a fraction of a second, then straightened from his bow and clasped forearms with the man who had become his emperor. The cheering redoubled, and Caleb smiled ever so faintly. He supposed there were rulers who would have felt it was imperative to stand upon their imperial dignity when meeting someone in Green Mountain's position for the first time. The Baron had been the mentor, protector, and effectively second father of Queen Charlian of Chisholm ever since Charlian had ascended to the throne as a mere child, and in many ways he was every bit as popular with her subjects, her common-born subjects at least, as she was. Many princes or kings who'd abruptly found themselves in Caleb's position would have felt legitimate concern about the ultimate loyalty of a man who'd been all of those things and enjoyed so much support and trust. The mere fact that Charlian had become Caleb's wife and the Empress of Caris, Caleb's co-ruler, might not have been enough to keep some other Green Mountain from seeking control of Chisholm for himself, especially since Charlian had remained behind in Caris rather than returning with Caleb. And too much familiarity with a man of such ambitions might all too easily prove fatal. Yet Caleb felt no concern about that at all, mostly because Charlian didn't, and Caleb trusted her judgment and her hard-headed realism implicitly. Almost as important, however, Captain Merlin Athrawes shared Charlian's judgment, and Captain Athrawes possessed certain advantages which were not available to other men when it came to evaluating the actions and beliefs of others. If Merlin Athrawes told Caleb a man was trustworthy, the Emperor was quite prepared to take him at his word, a word which had been amply confirmed by Merlin's reports on how firmly and ably Green Mountain and Queen Mother Alana had looked after Charlian's affairs in Chisholm during her absence. Of course, Green Mountain had no way to know anything of the sort, and just as Caleb had never met Green Mountain had never met him. Now Caleb held the Baron's arm in his clasp for a few moments longer. He looked levelly across at him, letting Green Mountain look into his own eyes. And Charlian's First Counselor accepted that invitation as he had accepted the Emperor's proffered hand. He looked deep, and Caleb met that searching gaze without flinching, his own eyes steady, until something inside Green Mountain's expression, something no one could actually have seen or described, seemed to ease somehow.
"Your Majesty, I—"
"A moment, my lord," Caleb interrupted, his voice pitched just a bit lower to form a sort of private alcove at the heart of the thunderous cheers still rising about them. Green Mountain's eyebrows arched, and the Emperor smiled at him.
"There are many things I'd like to say to you at this moment," Caleb continued. "Unfortunately, I'm well aware that there are any number of official things we need to be discussing instead, not to mention all of the public falderal we're both going to have to put up with. I assure you, I have my public face ready to put on for all of that. But first, the Empress, my wife, charged me most sternly, as my very first duty in Chisholm, to give you and her Queen Mother all of her love.
I... Green Mountain stopped and cleared his throat. I thank you for that, Your Majesty, he said after a moment, his own voice just a bit husky.
His hand tightened on the Emperor's forearm for a second. Then his nostrils flared as he inhaled deeply.
And now that you've